I gave a presentation to a group of vaccination professionals at CDC a couple of years ago about risk communication, and the main thrust of my argument was the main thrust of what I'm saying to you, that you know, when you're 95% right, you got to stop being dishonest about the other 5%. And the group was divided about in half in response. About half of them took the position that we're not dishonest about the other 5%. And about half of them took the position we're right to be dishonest about the other 5%. There were just a handful of people who said, gee, maybe you're right and we ought to change what we do. But there was a considerable group of people who just weren't able to notice that it's dishonest not to mention, when you mention 36,000 flu deaths a year, not to mention that they're mostly very elderly. That's a dishonest thing to do when you're talking to somebody who's young, for whom the 36,000 is absolutely irrelevant, because it's not mostly people in their age cohort. They wouldn't acknowledge that that was dishonest. But there were a large group of people who were preoccupied with the end rather than the means, who judged that, you know, while they probably wouldn't be willing to lie in order to get people vaccinated, they were willing to mislead in order to get people vaccinated. They were willing to tell those aspects of the truth that would encourage vaccination and leave out, not hide, not suppress for all time. It's all on the website. It's all in the technical journals. You know, it's all available if you care deeply. But they don't want to, they feel justified in not being candid, okay, in order to get people vaccinated. And in the short term, maybe they're right. My sense is, in the long term, and we are now living in the results of that long term, the result is very substantial loss in credibility. That more and more people know the ways in which they have been misled by public health, and far more people who don't know the ways in which they've been misled have accurately sensed that public health is not trusting them with the whole truth, is telling them only those parts of the truth that will lead them to do what public health wants them to do. Now, this is most vivid at the extremes. Okay, and let me tell you a story that, and I don't think this could happen today in the United States, but it's happening today in the world, and it's the same institutions that operate in the United States that are doing it. Let's talk about polio vaccination in those countries where polio has not yet been eliminated. There continues to be a polio problem in Nigeria. There continues to be a polio problem in Indonesia. There are countries where polio has not yet been eliminated. And the fear is, and it's a valid fear, that not only are people in those countries suffering from polio, which is a horrible disease, but also, you know, polio could come back from that base and even reestablish itself in the developed world. So there's a valid, important public health need to vaccinate people against polio. Now, there are two vaccines against polio. The live vaccine, which is administered orally, and the dead vaccine, which is administered with an inoculation, with a shot. When I grew up calling the dead one the Salk vaccine and the live one the Sabin vaccine. They're called IPV and OPV for, intravenous, intramuscular, I don't know what the I is, versus oral. The live one, the oral one, is a little bit dangerous. You can get polio from the live polio vaccine. It's very rare. It's like one vaccinee in a million gets polio from the vaccine. It's saving far more lives than it's killing. But it has that risk. And not only can a vaccinee get polio, but because the virus is live, it's in the excrement of the vaccinee, so you can actually give polio to people who haven't been vaccinated if you're using the oral vaccine. The dead vaccine, the vaccine that's a shot, is safer, And in the most developed countries, including the United States, we no longer use the oral vaccine. It's illegal to use the oral vaccine in the U.S. today. The oral vaccine is preferred in the developing world because it's cheaper and because it doesn't require a doctor. It requires a little bit of medical skill to give a shot. It requires no medical skill at all to put a couple of drops on a sugar cube. And so if you're doing a massive anti-polio vaccination campaign in Nigeria or in Indonesia, you wisely want to do the oral. Because you can get more people for less money, and you don't need as high a level of medical expertise. So it's good public health in the developed world to prefer the dead vaccine, and in the developing world to prefer the live vaccine. Those both make sense. Okay. However, in the developing world, and the CDC works on this, the World Health Organization works on this, a number of major international philanthropies work on this. They're doing oral polio vaccination in the third world, and they are flat out lying about the fact that it can give you polio. In Nigeria, starting in 2005, there was quite a substantial outbreak of vaccine-induced polio. Not just of vaccinees, but neighbors of vaccinees. There was an outbreak, a small epidemic of polio, not natural polio, but vaccine-derived polio. Okay, and the CDC was very interested in it. It followed it closely. Eventually, it wrote about it in MMWR. WHO was very interested. Everybody was, all the public health professionals were following that outbreak of vaccine-derived polio very carefully, all the while insisting to the people of Nigeria that the vaccine can't give you polio. There are imams in Nigeria who argue that polio vaccination is a Western genocidal plot, and they're urging their constituents, their followers, not to accept the polio vaccine. And in order not to give aid and comfort to the opponents of polio vaccination, the supporters of polio vaccination flat out lied about the reality that polio, the live vaccine can give you polio and was giving people polio, that there was this actual outbreak of polio. They were simultaneously studying it and claiming it didn't exist. I'm sure they feel virtuous about that. I'm sure they rightly feel they were saving lives. They certainly are absolutely right that the oral polio vaccine is the way to go. You can vaccinate a lot more people with a lot less money. They're certainly right that you're much better off taking a 1 in a million chance of with the polio vaccine than taking the much higher probability of getting polio if you go unvaccinated. There's no question that they're doing the right thing in giving the oral vaccine. I think they're doing the wrong thing in lying about it. I think they would be wiser that ultimately the imams are, it's not like the imams are stupid. They have the internet too. They go online and in 3 minutes they can find out that vaccine-derived polio is a real phenomenon. So the imams have better science at this point about vaccine-derived polio. The question here is which one is better. Well, there are two questions. One question is which one is better for polio vaccination in Nigeria, over the next 2 to 5 years. If you tell the truth and you say, listen, the vaccine has some problems, 1 in a million people will get polio. There is a vaccine that doesn't have that problem, but it's much more expensive. And in order to get the kind of coverage we want to get, in order to really deal with polio here in Nigeria, we need to use the oral vaccine. Is that the right way to go? Or is the right way to go to pretend that it's not a problem and to lie to people about the oral vaccine? Well, lying to people might be the right way to go, unethical, but it might be the best for public health if the imams weren't there, if the critics weren't there, if they didn't have the internet, if they weren't smart people who very quickly figure out that you're lying and attack you for it. So I would argue that even in the short term, even over the next 2 to 5 years, polio vaccination in Nigeria is in better shape, if you tell the truth, than if you try to suppress information about the dangers of the vaccine. That's all the more true if you broaden the question. You know, if you start saying, all right, look at the entire thrust of public health in the developing world. And which is better for the developing world being willing to trust public health, being willing to trust that when people come from developed countries and say, you know, I'm here from the United States and I'm here to help you, I come with vaccine to help save your people, that folks will say, yeah, okay, great, thank you, I'm really grateful, rather than, I don't know, I suspect this might be some kind of plot. Maybe this is really genocide pretending to be philanthropy. And it seems to me over the long haul, the case is even stronger that, you know, if you're not going to be able to ground public health in dishonesty. The piece of this that I know, and I mean, there may be stuff, I'm only a communication person, of course, so are you. The piece of this that I know is that the OPV, for the same reason that it can give non-vaccinees polio, which is to say it's live and it spreads, okay, it also gives you vaccination coverage of non-vaccinees. So the advantage of the live vaccine is, you know, if you're going to vaccinate as many people as you can, but you're going to miss some, either just because you missed them, they were out of town or they were hiding in the back room, or you didn't get to that village or whatever, or they refused, you can increase the protection for unvaccinated people with a live vaccine, with the oral polio vaccine, because their exposure to the excrement of their neighbors will, in fact, you know, stand a pretty good chance of protecting them as well. So you get much more herd immunity out of the oral vaccine than you get out of the dead inoculated vaccine, and that's important. That's another advantage of the oral vaccine until you get to the point where very few people are getting polio naturally. And, you know, it's at some point the danger of the oral vaccine gets higher than the benefits of the oral vaccine, economic benefits and this benefit of the fact that because it sheds, it gives some protection to non-vaccinees. And when the two curves cross, then it's good public health to switch. To the dead vaccine. There's no question that using the oral vaccine is the right way to go in the developing world. There's no question that it would be a great shame if Nigerians became unwilling to accept the oral vaccine and insisted on the dead vaccine, and an even greater shame if they became unwilling to accept vaccine at all. But the question is, which makes those tragedies likelier, telling the truth or not telling the truth? And, you know, and WHO, I am convinced, genuinely thinks those tragedies would be likelier if they told the truth. So they sadly lie in order to save lives. Okay. And, the ethics of that are debatable in either direction. But I just think they're wrong empirically. I don't think they're saving lives by lying. I think they're undercutting public health. Everybody in communication understands that ideally your messaging is adapted to each individual in your audience. I mean, you know, if you could go door to door talking about vaccines and inquiring of the person who answers the door, you know, how do you feel about vaccines and what are your concerns and what are your attitudes and how much do you know and how much do you want to know, and then tailor your message to that individual, you could do a hell of a good job. And that's just not doable. On the other extreme, if you have one message in a public service announcement and it's the only risk communication you're going to do about vaccination is your one, you know, broadcast message that's going out to everybody in the universe, then you're gonna, you know, you're gonna miss an awful lot of people for whom that's just the wrong message. You know, they knew that stuff already and they wanted more detail, or they're too skeptical for that stuff and we're not ready to believe that stuff coming from you until you acknowledge some of their concerns. You know, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about different kinds of risk communication. One size fits all is always crappy communication. Sometimes you have no choice, but it's always going to be suboptimal. I think while it's true that public health can't go door to door, okay, I think it's also true that they need to orient to a relatively small but more than one number of different audiences. One audience they need to orient to, and the hardest audience to reach, is the audience of people who are apathetic, who just aren't interested in vaccines, they're not worried about infectious diseases, they have lives, they find this stuff very boring. It's not that they're against vaccination, it's just that they don't think it's important for themselves or for their children. And they're hard people to reach. They're people who, you know, you say, I want to talk to you about vaccination, they close the door, they change the channel, they turn the page. In order to reach people who are really uninterested, it's necessary to keep your messages short. It's necessary to make your messages interesting. And I think public health can do a better job of that than they're doing, but they're trying awfully hard to do that. They absolutely need a different set of messages, at least two other different sets of messages. One is for critics and people who are listening to critics, for people who have real skepticism about vaccination safety, real skepticism about the value of government intrusion in their lives, real skepticism about whether public health as an enterprise can be trusted and what it says can be trusted. This is a growing group. It's an important group. And while it's probably impossible to convert your most committed opponents, talking to your most committed opponents in the presence of people who are not so committed, but they lean against you, they're skeptical, that's extremely important. Doctors need to do that because they're seeing patients who are in that category. But more fundamentally, public health needs to do that. There need to be public health campaigns aimed explicitly at skeptics. The third group, and it's one we haven't talked about much, is people who are reasonably well-informed. And they want more information. And they are offended by oversimplified information, not because they're hostile to vaccination, but because they're hostile to oversimplification. They see themselves as science fans or medicine fans. They may not read MMWR every week, but they know what it is. They may not hang out on the CDC website, but they've been there. And public health needs to address them also. And there's a need for balance. We could subdivide more than that, but if you just identify those three audiences, the people who are dangerously apathetic, the people who are interested and hostile to oversimplification, and the people who are skeptical or hostile to vaccination and worried about vaccine safety, if you had good campaigns for those three groups, you'd be way ahead. Well, I mean, look, safety trumps everything. If you're a vaccination proponent, you're a public health doctor who is closely identified with the pro-vaccination position, and you're working hard to reach out to your critics, and you start getting death threats, if I were in your shoes, I would stop reaching out. Your safety and the safety of your family, that preempts the effort to reach out to your critics. When that happens, and it's not common, but it's not unheard of, it has happened, When that happens, obviously, it's not feasible to have a productive dialogue with people who are so angry they want to kill you. Okay? On the other hand, it's extremely revealing that there are, you know, where the neighbor thinks the factory emissions has given their child cancer. It's pretty routine for people to get extremely angry and dangerously angry. And obviously, in those situations, you have to attend to your own safety first. But you have to work really hard with people who are not yet that angry to listen to their concerns and respond respectfully to their concerns, even if their concerns are off the wall. But especially if their concerns are 5% right.
Good.
But what's scary about a needle is you are intentionally and consciously allowing a foreign substance into your bloodstream. This is particularly scary if it's a vaccine. I mean, you know, vaccines are, to create a vaccine, you start with the disease. And you mess around with the bacterium or with the virus until you think you've created a weakened form or a dead form or some variation of the deadly thing that will work to protect people. That's counterintuitive. In order not to give you measles, I'm going to give you a measles shot, a shot with measles in it. In order to keep you from getting polio, I'm going to give you a shot that has polio in it. If you don't sort of start out thinking, gee, I don't know. I mean, I'm okay with the hair of the dog when I have a hangover, but I'm not sure I want the hair of the polio dog. I'm not sure I want the hair of the infectious disease dog. How do I know it's really dead if it's supposed to be dead? If it's alive but deactivated, weakened, how do I know it's been weakened enough? It's a huge leap of faith to let some doctor inject you with a deadly disease, especially when it's a rare deadly disease. Inject me with this rare deadly disease so I won't get it. Odds are I won't get it if you don't inject me with it. And now I'm trusting that bringing some altered version of this disease into contact with my bloodstream is safer than having no contact at all with this disease. That's hard to imagine. So I think shots are scary intrinsically, but vaccines are scarier than other shots. Most people are not scientists. They don't have a lot of expertise in science. They don't have a lot of confidence in their ability to understand science. They didn't do that well in science in high school. They're not sure how to use a Bunsen burner. They're certainly not sure how to read a technical report or a peer-reviewed journal article. And they don't want to do any of that. They have lives. So most of us make most of our decisions about technical questions, scientific questions, not based on an independent technical judgment, but based on the judgment of who we trust, of the people we trust. So, take it out of public health for a minute. If I'm trying to decide whether to take global warming seriously or not, I'm not a global warming expert, I have a choice. I can, take a few years off and study global warming science and climatology and reach an independent judgment about who's right, or I can decide who to trust. Most of the time I'm going to decide who to trust. It's much more parsimonious of my time. Okay. All right. Now that I've decided I'm going to rely on other people, I've got two choices still. I can decide who to rely on based on who's an expert, or I can decide who to rely on based on who I know. Okay. Well, If I trust expertise, if my experience tells me people with a great deal of knowledge are usually honest and usually disinterested, neutral, trying to inform me rather than trying to sell me something, then I may decide to rely on expertise. But increasingly in today's world, people have a sense, in my judgment, a justified sense, that most of the folks with a lot of expertise have an axe to grind. So now my choice is, do I trust people who know a lot, but they have an axe to grind? Or do I trust people who don't have an axe to grind, but they don't know as much? And most people on most issues wind up trusting their friends. They wind up, absorbing the not just the values of their friends, but the technical judgments of their friends. So if most of the people you know are anti-nuclear, you're anti-nuclear. If most of the people you know are anti-abortion, you're anti-abortion. If most of the people you know are anti-vaccination, you're anti-vaccination. And you're not studying the science, you're leaning on your social network. I think that's fair to say. Unlike nuclear power, unlike abortion, infectious diseases spread locally. They spread from individual to individual within a geographical region. So if people are getting their cues about whether to get vaccinated or not from their social network, which is to say the people around them, then we're going to have certain parts of the community where the vaccination rate is very high and there's lots of herd immunity. And I'm getting the benefit of the fact that all of us in this neighborhood are pro-vaccine and dutifully go get vaccinated. But then there's going to be another neighborhood on the other side of town where most of the people who are talking to each other have shared with each other a set of values that persuades them not to get vaccinated. So herd immunity is going to be non-randomly low instead of non-randomly high, and that's where your outbreak starts. I think that's a very good characterization. I am pro-vaccine, but even more pro-truth. And more to the point, I'm pro-vaccine without being terribly knowledgeable about vaccination. I'm pro-vaccine because, the people I hang out with are pro-vaccine. And I'm ignorantly pro-vaccine. Don't use the fact that I'm pro-vaccine as a reason why you should be, because I don't know anything. But I'm knowledgeably pro-truth. I have a lot of evidence that lying backfires even when it's in a good cause. That leaving out a small piece of the truth that works against your position undermines your position more than that small piece of the truth would. I want to talk briefly about good guys and bad guys, and in a little bit different way than you did. My sense is, after 40 years as a risk communication consultant, that in general, honesty is randomly distributed in the population as far as points of view are concerned. I don't think corporations are more or less honest than activist groups. I don't think public health vaccination proponents are more or less honest than opponents. I think that's pretty much a wash. But there are a couple of differences that are worth pointing out. One difference worth pointing out is you can get away with much more dishonesty, much more exaggeration when you're trying to warn people about something than when you're trying to reassure people about something. And that's not stupid. It's a kind of conservativeness. If a smoke alarm goes off and there's no fire, that's a minor problem. If there's a fire and the smoke alarm doesn't go off, that's a major problem. So we calibrate smoke alarms to go off too much so that they won't miss a fire. We similarly calibrate activists to go off too much so they won't miss a problem. So it's true that anti-vaccination people also distort, also mislead. Okay, but nobody really minds because they're warning about the dangers of vaccination. And when you're issuing warnings, you're allowed to exaggerate. Okay? But when public health, in response, trying to reassure people about vaccines, when public health exaggerates, when public health misleads and distorts, that's much less acceptable. That generates much more outrage on the part of people who catch on to the fact that they're being misled. That's one point, one difference I think is important to make. The other difference that I think is important is, by and large, traditional bad guys have figured out that when they lie, they get crucified. When they mislead, they get crucified. When they exaggerate, they get crucified. So, you know, when I go consult with a large corporation, a multinational corporation, they're tempted to lie. They're tempted to exaggerate. They're tempted to mislead. And obviously, sometimes they give in to that temptation. There's a long record of corporate dishonesty. But by and large, they kind of know that it's stupid. They still fall into the trap, but they kind of know they're probably going to get caught. When they get caught, they're going to get crucified. They know they're bad guys. They may not see themselves as bad guys, but they know, you know, if you're an oil company, you know the world sees you as a bad guy. If you're, you know, the public health officer for a community, you know, or for a state, the public sees you as a good guy. And you know the public sees you as a good guy. And you see yourself as a good guy. So you tend to be much more self-forgiving of exaggeration and distortion and dishonesty. You give yourself permission to be dishonest in a good cause. So although it seems to me intrinsically, public health is neither more honest nor less honest than oil companies, in practice, public health is less honest than oil companies because they feel more virtuous, they feel more entitled, and they feel less likely to get caught. Yeah, it's a very long, complicated question, but let me give an oversimplified answer to a complicated question. I think Big Pharma is often dishonest. I think it is often dishonest in much the same way that public health is often dishonest. It is dishonest not because it believes it is misleading people, but because it has some information that it believes would mislead people. And it wants to suppress that information. So, I mean, I think it's very rare for a pharmaceutical company to have a product, to have a drug, decide that that drug is incredibly dangerous, and then pretend it's safe. I don't think that happens, or at least I don't think that happens often. What happens is they have a drug, and their evidence suggests that the drug is safe, and their evidence suggests that the drug is effective, but there are some flaws in the evidence. And the pharmaceutical people find the evidence persuasive, but they're afraid the regulator won't, or the doctor won't, or the public won't. So they gild the lily. They make the evidence more persuasive than is true, not in order to mislead people, but in order to lead people, in order to help people understand what a good drug this is. And they think they're telling the truth. They think it really is a good drug. That's exactly what happens in public health. It happens less, I think, in the pharmaceutical industry than it does with public health officials because the pharmaceutical industry knows it's likely to get caught and the health officials feel they're not likely to get caught. Beats me. I don't know. I have been arguing this case for a long time. With all kinds of clients. For 40 years, I've been trying to persuade people that, that not as a matter of ethics, but as a matter of efficacy, if you're in a high controversy environment, telling the truth about the other side's good points is smarter than lying or misleading about the other side's good points. You do yourself more harm by telling half-truths than by telling the whole truth in a controversial environment. That's not true in an uncontroversial environment where nobody's pushing the other side. But in a controversial environment, you're much better off telling the whole truth. I've been trying to sell that argument for decades. I have some successes. But I have a lot of failures. It's a very tough sell. Do I think there's progress? A little. Do I think we're over the hump? No. I think it's very hard, and especially hard when you're working with people who have a deep, abiding sense that they're saving lives. And their commitment to public health is so deep that they're just not attentive to the ways in which they're undermining their own goals by being less than completely honest. Now, this is a question I'm often asked. All right, we've been dishonest, and we've been caught, and we are mistrusted. Can we unring the bell? Is there any path back? And the short-term answer is very often no. If you've lied to the people of Nigeria about whether the polio vaccine can give you polio, and you've been caught lying to the people of Nigeria on that question, they're not gonna trust you soon. Okay, but the midterm answer and the long-term answer is yes. We as a society, we keep giving people and organizations more chances. The price of a second chance is belated candor about your prior dishonesty. If you have misled people about the efficacy of the flu vaccine, it's not enough to start telling the truth about the efficacy of the flu vaccine. You have to start telling the truth about the fact that you have previously misled people about the efficacy of the flu vaccine. You have to do a mea culpa. And organizations that are willing to do a mea culpa, whether you're BP with regard to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, or you're the Centers for Disease Control with regard to misleading people about various aspects of swine flu, forgiveness awaits if you're willing to, to do two things. One, apologize, with chapter and verse for the ways in which you've been less than honest. And two, be more honest in future.